morning. It's good to be with you this morning and to have this time that we can share with one another. As Todd mentioned, we are going to be in the Sermon on the Mount. Before we get there, I do want to express my gratitude on behalf of the rest of my family to the congregation here for the care, for the concern, for the prayers on our behalf as we come to the final stages of Amber's pregnancy. We are expecting to deliver on the 31st, assuming all continues to go well. And so we ask that you would continue to pray for all of us in that. This year, as Cody and I have both mentioned, we're asking the question, what does it mean to be a Christian? And my part of that is for us to talk about the Sermon on the Mount and the idea of reaching for righteousness or seeking the righteousness of God. And as we get into the sermon, last time we talked about being teachers of righteousness and how we have to show righteousness in our lives if anybody's going to pay any bit of attention to us in terms of our teaching righteousness. And so the natural question is, well, what does that look like? We talked about that a little bit in that lesson, but as we get into the beginning of the sermon, I want us to think about it a little more. Now, if you were a first century Jew, and I were to ask you about righteousness, and about what does righteousness look like, what you might describe would be something similar to what we see in Luke chapter 18. This is Jesus' parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. And we have this description of the Pharisee who was standing and praying like this about himself. God, I thank you that I'm not like other people, greedy, unrighteous, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of everything I get. If you were to ask a first century Jew, well, what does righteousness look like? They say, go look at a Pharisee. And yet, as we know from this parable, and as we will talk about in just a moment, that wasn't going to quite work. But even in the 21st century, how many times have we thought the way the Pharisee prayed? How many times have we said, at least I haven't fill in the blanks? At least I'm not cheating on my spouse. At least I haven't killed somebody. At least, whatever you want to say, at least I haven't done that. Or how many times have we said, see how I've done this? I'm at the building every time the doors are open. I give of my means. I read my Bible. We can go on down the line, whatever checklist you want to fill out, and we say, look at these things and what of it? And so even if we might look back at the Pharisees and say, yeah, there's something wrong there, sometimes we're just like them. But Jesus points out the problem here when he says, and as we've mentioned already in the last lesson, in verse 20 of Matthew 5, for I tell you, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never get into the kingdom of heaven. And so, either Jesus is setting an impossible task, or righteousness means something different than what it meant to the scribes and the Pharisees. And so we get here to this Sermon on the Mount, as we call it. And Jesus begins with the series of statements we call the Beatitudes, based on the Latin word beatus, which means blessed. And the thing about this word is that it has to do with the original Greek word that's used here has to do with the idea of God's favor. It was originally used to describe that separate existence, the sublime existence that the gods, and again, this is a Greek word, so the Greek gods had. It was then extended to describe those to whom those gods showed particular favor. And so when we look at these statements of these people are blessed, sometimes we say, well, it means happy. Not really. Not in our modern sense of happy. Maybe 200 or 300 years ago, when the idea of happiness was more directly connected to God's favor, God's providence, perhaps, but not our modern sense of happy. What Jesus is describing here are those upon whom the Lord shows favor. And so it gives us this glimpse into this is what righteousness looks like. God is righteous in this very unique sense. We have that threefold, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. And by extension, we can be righteous if these things describe us. Now, and preachers will take one of two routes of talking about the Beatitudes. We're going to do both this morning. Often, the Beatitudes are described as, in more in terms of a portrait, a fixed moment in time picture of these are the qualities that someone has upon whom God shows favor. And then there's also this way of looking at them, and this is the way I typically talk about them, is this idea of a process of we look through and these Beatitudes give us a blueprint, a roadmap, if you will, of the path of pursuing God's righteousness. And we're going to somewhat take that view to start with, and we're going to come back around to seeing the portrait as a whole. But what does righteousness look like? Righteousness, as we see it here in this snapshot, is seen in someone who needs, seeks, and extends God's grace. You're going to get a two-for-one today on grace. After I was working through this, I looked back and realized that this was the last lesson in the material that I gave Jeff. So, worst case, you're going to hear it twice. Best case, Jeff gets more time to talk about other things. Either way, it'll work. But righteousness is seen in someone who needs, seeks, and extends God's grace. And as we begin into this, we see first the someone who needs God's grace. Jesus says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted." Now, I want to qualify this statement that I have up here, in that everyone needs God's grace. Okay, that's an unquestioned, unqualified statement. Everybody needs God's grace. But what we need to get into are those who recognize their need for grace. Later on, after the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is going to have an encounter with the Pharisees, and they ask him why he's talking with the tax collectors and so on. And he talks about, well, it's not those who are well who need a physician, but those who are sick. And Jesus' point was not that the Pharisees were well and so didn't need a physician, but, you know, preventative medicine notwithstanding, if you don't think you're sick, are you very quick to go to a doctor? Not usually. And so what we're dealing with here, and what we're dealing with is being poor in spirit, is that we are recognizing this gap that exists, this gap between us and God. This gap that's created by sin. The fact that without God and without God's grace, we have no hope of bridging that gap. And we recognize the consequences of that. Talks about blessed are those who mourn. When we think about the gap that exists between us and God, what do we do? How do we process that? Now, it's not saying that we need to go around crying all the time. But Luke in Acts 2 described those on the day of Pentecost who heard Peter's message and understood what Peter was saying, that they were among those who either had participated in crucifying or had gone along with it. But they had crucified the Messiah. They recognized that. They recognized the consequences of that. It says they were pierced to the heart. Recognizing the gap that exists between myself and God should provoke this reaction. I shouldn't proceed as if nothing's wrong, as if there's no issue here, as if it doesn't matter. I need to act like someone who needs God's grace. And it's those who recognize that need. It says, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. They will be comforted. But it's not enough just to recognize the need and have a reaction to that need. Because righteousness doesn't just look like someone who needs God's grace. It also looks like someone who seeks God's grace. Verse 5 says, blessed are the humble, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. And I'm going to skip to verse 8. It says, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Righteousness looks like someone who doesn't just need God's grace, but is seeking God's grace. That someone who we recognize that it's God's the one who has to bridge the gap for us. That it's not something that we can do. That word humble, or meek, your version may say, or gentle, sometimes I think is misunderstood a little. Where it's not talking necessarily about someone who just rolls over and just lets whatever happen, whatever happens happen. Probably the best definition I've heard of about this idea of meekness or humility or gentleness in the scriptures is strength under control. And the idea here, when we're told to be gentle or be humble, is that we bring the strength that we have under God's control. We let God determine how it gets used. And so Jesus showed that gentleness, showed that humility, when in spite of having the power to call down legions of angels to deliver him, he submitted to the Father's will and died on the cross. But in perhaps what seems like a contradictory example, Phinehas, back in Numbers, was also gentle in that his strength was under God's control when he followed the Israelite into the tent with a spear and used it to end the plague at Peor. Both had their strength under God's control. We must put our strength under God's control. And that's something that's visible. Peter talks about this, and particularly in 1 Peter, in our interactions with those who are persecuting us, and we'll get to persecution in just a little bit. But you know, they see our conduct. They recognize there's something different about us and how we deal with that. Because we aren't lashing out because we can or because we don't like what's going on. But our strength is under God's control. And here, we rely on God. It's not we're powering through and seeing what we can do that makes us think that we're righteous. But we put our strength under God's control and do what He says to do. We seek God's solution. He says, you will hear, talk about the pure in heart, this pure motive. It's not out of some contrived what I can get out of this. But we seek God's righteousness. Talks about in verse 6, hungering and thirsting after righteousness. Because of what it is. Because it's God's righteousness. Because it's worth hungering and thirsting after. And just how much do we seek that? Well, again, in verse 6, this idea of hungering and thirsting. This is not so much the kind of hungering and thirsting that happens when we haven't eaten for a few hours and our stomach starts rumbling. But rather, seeking God's righteousness as if we're going to die if we don't get it. Guess what? We are. If we don't pursue God's righteousness and pursue it God's way, what awaits us is death. We have to seek God's righteousness. We seek God's grace. And so righteousness looks like someone who needs God's grace, who seeks God's grace. But once we get it, that's not the end of the story. That's not the end of the path here. Because it also looks like someone who extends God's grace. Verse 7 says, "Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy." Verse 9, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs." When we talk about extending God's grace, we have received God's grace. There's this great gift that has been given to us. But God's grace is not something for us just to hoard. But it's also something for us to show to others. We are extensions of God's grace. Sometimes in God's showing grace, He uses us to show grace to others. And so we show the grace that we have been shown. Most immediately and most obviously, we talk about spreading the gospel. We have the grace of the gospel has been revealed to us, and so we share it with others. But we think about passages like in Ephesians chapter 4, when Paul talks about let the thief no longer steal, but let him labor with his hands so that he may have something to give to anyone who has need. God has given us so much. Who are we to withhold from others? And in fact, Jesus says, it's the ones who are merciful who will be shown mercy. Later on in the sermon, when Jesus gets to talking about prayer, he's going to talk about forgiveness. And he'll say in chapter 6, if you don't forgive others their transgressions, your Father in heaven won't forgive you. And so it's not enough just to be a recipient of God's grace. In some ways, that being a recipient, receiving God's grace, is contingent on us being willing to show God's grace. Verse 9 talks about being peacemakers. And very often, the definition of peace, the working definition of peace in Scripture is not quite what we think of as peace. We think of Neville Chamberlain's infamous statement 100 years ago where he talks about achieving peace for our time. And we recognize with the long view of history that Chamberlain's appeasement of Germany did not achieve peace. It just delayed war. Peace in Scripture is not merely the absence of open conflict. But peace very often talks about bringing two things into harmony with each other. In Ephesians chapter 2, Paul talks about Jesus through his sacrifice having broken down the wall of separation between the Jews and the Gentiles and bringing the two together into one body, achieving peace. And so when Jesus says, blessed are the peacemakers, those who make peace, he's not just talking about those who get people to stop fighting, but those who seek to bring harmony, especially harmony with God. And they are the ones who will be called sons of God. But the reality, of course, is that these efforts to extend God's grace are not always so well received. So righteousness looks like someone who seeks God's grace for others no matter what. Jesus goes on to talk about those who are persecuted because of righteousness. Verse 11, he says, you are blessed when they insult you and persecute you and falsely say every kind of evil against you because of me. Be glad and rejoice, because your reward is great in heaven. For that is how they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Not everyone is going to want peace. Not everyone is going to want to bring their lives in harmony with God. Sometimes they will react poorly to that. And one thing I want to say about this persecution, and again, what we think about persecution may not be quite what Jesus and the apostles thought about persecution, thought persecution was. Because notice what things Jesus describes here, and as he reinforces this last idea of being persecuted because of righteousness, says when they insult you and persecute you and falsely say every kind of evil against you because of me. When Jesus and the apostles talk about persecution and enduring through persecution, they aren't just talking about physical beating. They aren't talking about being thrown to prison, being put to death, all of those things that maybe we normally think of as being real persecution. But persecution is simply opposition to the message. And that opposition takes any number of forms. Yes, it may result in being thrown to prison and being put to death, and Jesus talks about that in a few more chapters in Matthew's gospel. But it may be as simple as someone who chooses to insult you because they don't like what you're saying. They look for a way to discredit you, because they don't like the message you're bringing. And Jesus saying, blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, doesn't mean that we go around looking for it. But it means that when it happens, and when it happens because we are genuinely spreading God's message and extending God's grace. And Peter talks about the difference between those two things, of the reasons for persecution. It means that God sees it and he looks upon it with favor. And those who are willing to endure through that persecution, no matter how light or how heavy it is. God recognizes that. And you may have noticed as we've gone through this that these arrows have been overlapping, because this is not a strict handoff that we go from needing to seeking, and then once we're seeking, we stop needing, and then when we go from seeking to extending, we stop seeking. But these keep building on each other. And even once we get to what we might think of as the end of that line, where we've done those things, the process never stops. We are in this continual cycle of needing and seeking and extending God's grace. Because guess what? As we grow, as we continue to follow God, we're going to keep finding ways in which we need God's grace, and in which we can seek God's grace, and in which we can extend God's grace to others. And at any given time, righteousness is seen in someone who needs, who seeks, and who extends God's grace. We close. I want to think about this. Do you recognize your need for God's grace? Do you recognize the gap? What you lack, that you need God to provide. And it's not always about sin. Yes, the primary sense of grace that we deal with most often is about our need for salvation. But we need God for a whole lot of things that don't always have to do with sin. Do we recognize our need for God's grace? And once we recognize it, are we seeking that grace? Are we seeking God's grace by God's terms? Or are we like Naaman back in 2 Kings chapter 5, where he gets told, this is how you're healed, and he scoffs at it the first time, because it wasn't quite what he was expecting. And once we've sought God's grace, are we extending it to others? Are we showing the grace that we have been shown, so that others may learn to need, seek, and extend that grace? We began with the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector, and I suppose it's fitting that we end there with the tax collector's side of the story. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even raise his eyes to heaven, but kept striking his chest and saying, God, have mercy on me. This, unlike the Pharisee, was a man who saw his need for grace and sought grace, sought mercy. If we can help you with that, let us know as we stand and as we sing.